And we've been talking about anxiety, and we're going to talk about anxiety and the idea of magic numbers. There are magic numbers. There are certain things that we think of that if I do it so many times, it will work. It will change the course of history. What are some of those numbers? You think about, you do something like three times, right? Or how about this one? You know, bad luck always comes in what?
Three.
You see, you knew that, right? You knew, it says it here, but it also, you knew that. People say, you know, or the other one is they'll say something and they then knock on wood, right? That what does that mean? It's going to come true. You know, you say, somebody says something hopeful, and then people all knock on wood to say, well, we hope it will be true. And we have all sorts of kinds of things around this. And the reason we have this is because, in general, we're negative. We look, you know, when you drop your peanut butter and jelly piece of bread, what side is going to hit down? The peanut butter and jelly side will, we always assume, is going to be on the floor, right? Because if it wasn't, we wouldn't be able to go out and spend hundreds of dollars on those new devices that clean floors and rugs. But we just have this assumption that things are going to go bad. You know, it is. Remember, there was a thing, Murphy's Law. You remember, what did Murphy's Law say? Anything that can go wrong will. And so we're sort of maybe not hardwired, but we're softwired to assume the negative.
Oh, whenever something his happens. Life is nothing but sorrow.
Sorrow.
This is
nothing but sorrow and woe.
And a poor soul. You remember that? You all are not old enough to remember this.
Nobody cares if he lives or he dies. He's a poor soul, neglected and spurned, lonely and sad as can be.
He was engaged to a beauty.
Beauty.
Who ran off and left him alone. She sent back the ring that he gave her, but she never sent back the stone.
He's a poor soul that nobody loves. Nobody cares if he lives or he dies. He's a poor soul, neglected and spurned, lonely and sad as can be.
And that's, you know, he was a character. Jackie Gleason created this character sort of as to honor vaudeville and also silent movies. But the character, I remember being this one moment time watching the show. The introduction was, you know, if living your life is, you know, it's always darkest before the dawn. You've heard that. Then this guy lives at 4 o'clock in the morning because everything is negative with him. And, you know, we all then take those, we may not have those exact same ideas or feelings, but we ask the question, don't we? Don't we ask the question, but what if? You know, something, oh, but if this had happened, then this other thing never would have occurred. Or because this happened, my life has been changed dramatically. It's like this scene from You've Got Mail with Tom Hanks.
You know, sometimes I wonder.
What?
Well, if I hadn't been Fox Books, and you hadn't been the shop around the corner, and you and I had just met.
I know.
Yeah. I would have asked for your number. And I wouldn't have been able to wait 24 hours before calling you up and saying, hey, how about how about some coffee or, you know, drinks or dinner or a movie? For as long as we both shall live.
Joe.
And you and I would never have been at war. And the only thing we'd fight about would be which video to run on a Saturday night.
Well, who fights about that?
Well, some people. Not us.
We would never.
If only. How many times have we said those words? And we don't say them with joy normally, we say them with regret or sadness. If only this other thing had happened or not. And some of us live with those consequences for the rest of our life. We say, if only I had changed. If only I hadn't done that. If only I hadn't made that turn. If only I hadn't said those words. If only I hadn't made that choice. And sometimes those things hang on, don't they? And I was reminded of this past week because it was the 60th anniversary of the assassination of Kennedy. Most of you were not alive at the time that this happened, but there was one guy who carries the weight of that day even now. His name is Clint Hill. We know him, maybe not personally, but we know the image of him. We know the image of him racing from the car behind the president and trying to protect the president and the first lady. And he got there seconds too late as that final deadly bullet hit the president. And he lives, even to this day, he's 90, he just celebrated his 91st birthday. And he still lives under the weight of saying, let me read a little bit of what he says. He says, before Dallas, I was known just as Clint Hill. After that, I've been known as the man who climbed onto the president's car. That 6-second period in Dallas, it's not an easy thing to live with. As I look at her face, streaked with tears, her eyes so hollow and lifeless, a wave of guilt and shame washes over me. How did I let this happen? He still lives under this. And in an interview with Mike Wallace, he tearfully surmised that if he had reached the vehicle seconds earlier, that he could have taken the shot that and hit him instead of the president. And how he has this great regret for not doing it. And this feeling didn't pass. You know, after this, he stayed on in the with the Secret Service and served more presidents until when he turned 43 years old, the weight and the guilt and the shame had eaten away his body. And he couldn't pass his physical to remain a Secret Service agent, and he had to retire early. His on all of this because of just 6 seconds. Just 6 seconds changed everything. And whether or not he should have allowed this to change him, it has. And he doesn't know what to do with it. And it's that what if, that only if, eats his lunch still each and every day. You know, so how do we know when we've come to that point? How do we know what to do? How do we turn to God and say, how much is enough? How do I find that out? Do I go to God just once? Do I go to God continually? Do I go three times? Do I go seven times? There's got to be a magic number, right? There's got to be a magic number that says, if I do this so many times, and whatever that magic number is, then everything will be good, right?
Keep asking, keep knocking.
But it's interesting to see how God responds at different points in time. You know, we have the story of Elijah and the widow at Zarephath, and he comes to her, he asks for food, she gives it, and then the boy gets sick and dies. And Elijah has all of this guilt on him, says, God, wasn't it enough? And now you've killed this boy, and it's all on me. So what did Elijah do? He stretched himself out on the boy three times. And every time he cried to the Lord, Lord, my God, let this boy's life return. And the Lord heard, and his life returned. And he cried. What does it mean to cry out to the Lord?
All your energy, everything.
All your energy, everything. You ever hear the expression, don't leave it, if you play golf, it's don't leave it in the bag, right? Don't hold back. And we cry out to God. And that's what Elijah did. He gave it, he gave all of his frustration. He really did. Or how about Elisha, his successor? There was a guy by the name of Naaman who had leprosy. And he comes and says, you know what? You're a prophet of God, I've heard. Just wave your hand over it, say some mumbo jumbo, and, it'll be all better. But Elisha says, doesn't even come out. He sends a messenger to Naaman and says, go, wash yourself seven times in the River Jordan. And how do you think? Naaman is a big guy. He's a big general. He's at the top. And, he's come all this way. He wants, the expectation is, Elisha, get your butt out here, pray, and everything will be fine. It's like in the movie Patton, where in the Battle of the Bulge, Patton calls for a chaplain to write a prayer for victory. And afterwards, the chaplain writes a prayer and he prays it and the sky is clear. And that's exactly what Patton thought. And Patton's reaction is, I'm going to put a medal on his chest for writing such a good prayer because he's in good with God. But Naaman, I just love Naaman. He's so honest. How did he go away?
Angry.
Have you ever gone away angry from God? I have. You say, God, he say, listen to this. He says, I thought. Have you ever gone to God and had say, God, I have the answer for you? You know what? Let me give you the 411. Let me give you some information. Let me tell you what you need to do. Now, you're the God of all eternity and all power, but I've got the secret formula. I know. So what did he know? He said, surely he would come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord. Whose God? His God, not my. Who is this guy? The God? No, it's his God. He's going to call him out. And then he's going to wave his hand over the spot. And what's going to happen? And cure me, right?
Like a magic wand.
Exactly, like a magic wand. This is David Copperfield all over again, or whoever else. You know, it's a formula. We say the magic words, we wave our hand, we say the magic prayer, and presto, God jumps through a hoop for you and for me. But he thought, and that's where he went wrong. He thought on himself. He didn't go to God and say, God, what do you want to do here? What's your plan? How can I become part of that plan? No, he said, I got this wired. I know what should happen. And so Naaman, finally, he talks to his servants, and they convince him to do what the guys, what Elisha said. So what is his servant stepped in to tell him, and now he went down, and what did he do? He dipped himself. Now, this isn't baptism, okay? This is what the Jordan River mostly looks like. Does that look like a river? What does that look like? A little creek or a creek. I don't know where you're from. It's most of the time, it's just this little thing. So how do you dip yourself into this? You got to get down on your knees and roll around in the water. Does that sound very posh?
No.
There, you know, he's a big general, and here he is. He's got to get down 7 times. He's got to get down there and up and down and up. And he did it as the man had told him, the man of God told him. You see, he had to not do what he thought. He had to do what God said to do. And then Naaman, after he's now cured, Naaman and all his attendants went back to Elisha, and he stood before him and said, now I know. I thought I knew. I thought I had, you know, I had God in a box. You know, God, this is the way you got to work. I got my timeline. You know, God, if you answer this prayer before this certain date, then I can go on with my life. But he says, now I know that there is no God in all the world except you. I mentioned earlier that I haven't had a very good week. I've been going through a thing that is just eating my lunch. Do you ever have a thing that eats your lunch? You know what I'm talking about. It just seems like you can't get over it. And this has to do with just something I'm really dealing with. And I keep saying, but God, you're going to fix this, right? You're going to fix this. And you know what? It's really embarrassing, this whole thing. You know, if people knew about what was going on, they would, you know, what would they think of me? Because where's all my attention? On me. And how I'm going to fix it and this thing. And, you know, it's just coming to the point for me, because I'm stubborn. I don't know if you figured that out. Say open hands. See, now I know, God, you've got to take care of this. And I got to take my hands off of it. I'm not a hands-off kind of guy. And, you know, I want to let go. I have let go. But guess what? I grab it back. So this is, you know, my struggle as like, you know, there's got to be a time where I can lay it down. It's like, I don't know if you come from a tradition like I did, but priests, when you become a priest, you actually go through part of the process. It's called prostration. Part of the ceremony, the dedication into the priesthood, is you lay down in front of God and in front of his people. And they're saying, I'm giving everything I have. And I'm making myself vulnerable. Because how can you protect yourself when you're laying down? You can't. They're saying, God, whatever you want to do to me is okay. I don't know that I'm at that point. In my head, I want to be at that point. In my heart, I want to be at that point. But my will is saying, I got to hold on. I got to protect myself. I got to, you know, I got to maintain control. And Naaman has done this, and he's come to the point of letting go. You know, it's like what Paul said, that he had a problem. And his problem was a thorn in the flesh. We don't know exactly what it was. It wasn't happiness. It was painful. It was awful. Might have been disfiguring. And he was, why was he given this problem? So he wouldn't be conceited. What's conceited mean?
Thinking about yourself.
Yeah, I got this, God. I've got this. And he says, I was given a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan. Ooh, that sounds tough. Why? To torment me. Why is the torment? Again, to keep from being conceited. Paul had everything. And it would have been very easy, very natural for him to say, you know, I can walk into a town, snap my fingers, preach a sermon, boom, a church appears. But he is given it to torment. It's not a fun ride. The torment means to be hit with fists, you know, to be cut deeply. That God is so desperate to get our attention that he'll do anything. Some people wonder, why do I wear a jacket, right? You know, I see a lot of short sleeve shirt people here, right? Why? Why do you wear short sleeve shirts?
To stay cool.
It's comfortable to stay cool. So you're thinking, something's wrong with Chet's thermometer, right? My thermostat is off. Well, it's because of my pride. Is it okay to say that?
Sure.
Okay. It's because of my pride. Because I have my father's skin, which is from my mother, my Busha's skin, which is Polish. And every time I get bumped, I get these deep bruises on my arms. And I'm like, I don't want anybody to see that. Wow, that shows that I'm weak, shows that I'm, dare I say the word, old. That I have weakness. But could it be that God's allowing this because he's not done with me yet? Could it be that you've got whatever that thing that you're thinking about upside in your head and it is rolling around in the back while we've been talking, that God says, I'm not done with you either. When Paul did this, what did he do? He pleaded three times. He pleaded. He said, God, take it away. And what was God's response? My grace is sufficient. Now, there's an interesting thing about this, and I don't know exactly how to read this. Paul said three times, right? Take it away. Did God say, my grace is sufficient once? Or did he say, my grace is sufficient three times? I don't know the answer to that question. But I'm going to assume that God's kindness was great and God was willing to repeat himself. even to Paul, three times. It was made perfect. And I know the question that's running through your head right now, the question that's running through your head, that's the burning issue that you've got to get an answer to is, why does he have a telescope as his background picture, right? Weren't you thinking that? Go ahead, admit your weakness. You were saying, what's wrong with Chet? I'll tell you what's wrong. Well, I can't, we don't have enough time to go into what's wrong with Chet. But when it says made perfect, the image of that word is like one of these telescopes. How do you store one of these things? All short, right? But is that the way you look through it?
No.
What do you have to do? Take it all, not just part of the way, all the way. So it becomes fully deployed, if I can use that, fully extended to the way it's made to be fully pulled out, right? How's that for English? Fully pulled out. I'm from Baltimore. What can I say? So, but that when it says made perfect, he's saying, God is saying, my grace is fully deployed, fully pulled out, fully shown to the way it was intended to be seen by you and other people. When my grace is shown, it's sufficient. His power is made perfect in weakness. And we sort of like, you know, God's power, what do we want? We want what? Boom, right? We want big things like this volcano. You know, we want God to show up in a big way, you know, fireworks, you know, seen, heard, you know, lots of people, lots of videos, you know, all big things. But most of life here on planet Earth, with you and me especially, is in what? The little things. The little things is where God moves. And there's this one of my favorite characters in the Bible. Her name is Dorcas. She goes by, I know, she's a dork, right? Her name actually means gazelle, okay? And she was a widow. And what did she do? Did she bounce from bridge club to bridge club? Nothing wrong with bridge. Did she go and gossip? Did she go to the, you know, spend time in the beauty parlor? Nothing wrong with the beauty parlor. What she did was she sewed. And when you sew, you're normally sewing by yourself. Now, we don't know if she did it alone, you know, and have, you know, she was sick. Peter went, came to where she had died. And these women, these widows, weeping, showing him tunics and garments that she had shown, that she had sewed. That's a godly life. She wasn't on stage, you know. She wasn't interviewed by Christian television. She was doing what she was supposed to be doing in a back room somewhere. But she was impacting all sorts of lives. You see, you never know where it's going to happen. It's like in World War II. There is an islands off the coast of France, the Channel Islands. And during World War II, the Germans took them over. Well, the people wanted to fight against the Germans. And so what are the first things that come to your mind when you're going to fight the Germans? What are some of the things you would think about?
Bombing.
Right? Get some guns, right? You know, cut off their communication, cut the wires, you know, disrupt them. There was a group of women who knitted scarves and mittens and head coverings for the British Army. And you're thinking to yourself, why? You get cold. Let me tell you where it gets cold. When you're flying an airplane. And they didn't have heat back then. And they were open. And these women, their mittens and their scarves and their head coverings were a godsend to these pilots because you could freeze up there. It allowed them to fight. Now, the women were just knitting. But don't you think those pilots said, thank God for those women and what they did? You know, it was nothing significant. Socks, mittens, head coverings. And yet, the pilots thought of them as fellow workers in the fight. Fellow workers in the fight. Wasn't big, wasn't flashy. It's like my friend Lois. No, excuse me. It's like my friend Lois. One more. Lois and Ben are a family that we got to know when we lived in Delaware. And one day, one of their daughters brought home a guy. And we knew Ben and Lois from church, deeply committed people to Jesus. And one of their daughters brings home a guy who's from Turkey. Nice guy. He's not a Christian. He's a Muslim. His family is Muslim. That's all he's ever known. And what does Lois do? Well, Lois belonged to a group that was called BYKOTA. And that stood for Be Ye Kind One to Another. It's from Ephesians. And so she decided she was going to be kind to Bora and be nice to him and welcome him. It was through the testimony of kindness that Bora eventually talked to someone and gave his heart to Jesus Christ. Not because she was smart, not because she could argue why Islam was wrong and Christianity was right, but she earned the right to show it by showing it.
She was part of the church.
She was part of the church, a very powerful part of the church. And it wasn't up front. You know, when it's in their kitchen, on their back porch, you know, wherever. Not a public thing at all. So, you know, when we talk about when we come to these points in our lives where trouble comes and this anxiety comes, here are three things. I saw this from Rick Warren, and I just thought it was terrific. First is know that God knows every emotion you feel. Is that hard to comprehend? But he does. He knows it. We have the promise of his word. The Lord gave each of us a mind, and nothing we can say can be hidden from him. God is never, never surprised by anything we say. It's not like, how did he get there? How did she get there? What did they do? So we can speak freely. We can speak freely to God. We can unload. God's shoulders are immense and strong. We can come to him. We can unload our burdens on him. Secondly, God understands your feelings better than you do. You think, how is that possible? Well, let me tell you, don't you get confused with your feelings? One day you're like this, then you're like that. You think this way, not that. God understands our feelings. The Lord knows what is in everyone's mind. He understands everything you think. You know, he always understands. this is just so attractive. Why wouldn't we want to go to him? What's the point of hiding from him when he already knows it? And, you know, God, you know, and God has is talked about in terms of emotions. He gets angry, he's sad, he's happy. He laughs. Third, God loves to listen to us. He loves to listen. You know, I love the Lord because he hears me. He listens to me every time I call to him. God is a listening God. God also loves to ask questions of us. When Adam and Eve sin, what does God do? Does he blast them?
No.
Does he throw them? Does he just scream and yell at them?
He asks them a question.
He asks them a question. And then what does he do? He listens. He listens. God is a listening God. He's never too busy. You ever know, I get impatient with people. I know you find that hard to believe. Now, I was on the phone the other day with a guy, and he was asking me all these questions. I was like, well, I think you've got your answer. And guess what he did?
He kept going.
And I said, well, I think you answered your question, didn't you? Isn't that just what you said? And he went on for another 10 minutes. You know that feeling? You know that guy?
Yeah,
we all got him. God never hangs up on us.
No.
He's never too busy. He doesn't have a short attention span. God is always attentive. He's that kind of God. So what is our response? If we can bring our anxieties and all this to him and tell him our fears, we should live expectantly. We should live even in the midst of all the crap that's going on around us, if you don't mind me using that phrase. We can live expectantly and joyfully because God is on our side. Not because of anything we've done, but because of what he did. In Jesus Christ, we are his children, and he takes care of his children. Life is full and running over with opportunities. The question is, what am I going to do with them? Am I going to sit with my thumb in my mouth like Linus? Or am I going to pout like Chet? I can pout with the best of them. Or are we going to say, God, you got this, and you've got me. I'm going to walk with you today. Forgive me for taking the weight on myself. And let me delight in you today. Doesn't say it's going to solve the problem. Doesn't say it's actually going to make the problem go away. But we got a God who's with us, a God who loves us, God who cares deeply for us. And we can live, maybe not exactly like that, but close. Live expectantly, live joyfully because God is in control. And that's a good thing. Would you pray with me? Our Father and our God, I thank you that you are good. You are good all the time. And that you have made yourself available to us. You came down in Jesus Christ to solve the biggest problem we got, our sin, ourselves. And that now you rejoice in your children. God, forgive us, forgive me when I take the reins out of your hands and try to solve it myself. I thank you that you are the kind of God who will take it back. We love you in Jesus' name. Amen.